Is that right? We got some brothers in the grad class trying to work on, several of them have computers, and one's trying to work on a program for a Hebrew for his. I don't think his is a Commodore or something, but it's very interesting. The teachers sure like these computers, I'll tell you that. To get the papers turned in like that, boy, it's nice.
Makes it nice for me.
Yeah, especially for the graduate level classes for your...
That's one of the reasons I was looking at tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
The advantages
that
would be later on,
yeah.
Not only normal
classrooms,
but further on.
Yeah, really. I envision someday having a graduate research facility with computer terminals and everything, you know. Lord willing, it would sure be nice.
They're developing research.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's no reason why we shouldn't. But to make the best advantage, advantageous usage of things we can. Today I want to finish reviewing for the quiz that will be next Tuesday, a week from today, November 1st. And as you recall, that quiz will cover chapters 7 through 11 inclusive, and also the accent rules that we've covered so far. And so we were reviewing last time. We got to chapter 10 in our review, so I want to look at chapters 10 and 11 today. Quick review of those accent rules and let you know exactly what you'll be responsible for on the test as far as those accent rules is concerned. And then we'll get started with chapter 12 today and the Greek verb. On chapter 10, we dealt with the genitive case. And this chapter was done in a sort of inductive fashion again, where he gives you numerous examples of the use of the Greek genitive, and then gives you some exercises to deduce some things about it. And then, or actually induce general principles from the specifics. Then we talk a little bit about the syntax. Any questions about the forms? That's pretty much a matter of memorizing the paradigms. There's really nothing more to belabor this point about, unless there's any problems or questions or misunderstandings on any of these genitive forms. So now that you have your full paradigm for these things, it's just a matter of learning the paradigm for the genitive. And of course, like all the other cases, if an adjective modifies a noun in the genitive, the adjective will also be in the genitive. Now, so the forms of the genitive, there's just a few observations about that in section 74 here. And not really worth taking any closer look at, except perhaps this point number 2 on the top page 58. And that is, a few masculines of the first declension which have their nominative singular in alpha sigma have their genitive singular in alpha rather than omicron upsilon. These are for the most part proper names, like Stephanus, and the genitive being Stephana. So for practical purposes, it's true to say that all masculine nouns of the first and second declension have omicron upsilon in the genitive singular. So with this exception, in the first declension, your masculines are going to take omicron upsilon in the first declension as well as in the second declension, in the genitive singular. But there is this unusual situation with proper names. And for the test, I won't really hold you responsible for any proper names, except for, did we have those in chapter 11? I guess we did, yes. There's two paradigms in chapter 11, the one for Judas and the one for Jesus. Those two you should be familiar with. But other than that, and the one for Judas is an example of this one, that this situation that he's discussing here, where you get an alpha ending for the genitive. Okay. But I guess we'll cover that in lesson 11. Syntax of the genitive case. Main point here, as far as the syntax is concerned, is that the genitive case functions very much like an adjective, in that it's modifying a noun usually. In some cases we'll see it modifying participles and other things, but for now we'll just consider it modifying a noun. And because it's functioning like an adjective, it's not surprising then that the genitive phrases occur in positions that adjectives occur in. And remember, we had four positions for the adjective with an articular noun. Those same four positions show up with the genitive case. The main difference being that with the four positions in the genitive case, the meaning is always the same. It's always attributive. You don't have what we call a predicate meaning and an attributive meaning. We have those predicate positions and attributive positions, but they're all coming out with attributive meaning. So that's your major distinction there. And he points this out. Section 75 just talks about the fact that it's generally a possessive idea or some idea translating with the word of in English. So if you see a genitive phrase in Greek, try translating it of in English, of something, of whatever it is, and you'll pretty much be on the mark. And in some cases it'll be possessive, other cases it won't be. Section 76 is general and true, that when a noun in any case is modified by a noun in the genitive case, the noun in the genitive is anarthrous. If the noun it modifies is anarthrous. Again, this is the general rule. If the noun it's modifying is anarthrous, then it will be anarthrous. That's usually the case simply because of the fact that if you're dealing with an anarthrous noun, you're dealing with a rather indefinite concept. And if you're putting a modifier on that indefinite concept, the modifier is generally going to be indefinite as well. Now, this is the general rule, of course. There may be some exceptions to this. And we'll consider the exceptional situations more a little bit later on. We're not attempting to get into those things yet. Then, section 77, with anarthrous noun, the noun and the genitive may either precede or follow. So the position for an anarthrous noun, the genitive may be either before it or after it. Just like the adjective on an anarthrous noun may be either before or after. There's no difference in position here, really, as far as labeling these positions. Because you don't have any article to define these other positions. Then section 78 deals with those four positions. Attributive, first attributive, second attributive, first predicate, and second predicate positions. Meaning, though, is the same in all these cases. It's always got an attributive meaning. So the difference is primarily one of emphasis, and the most common position that you'll see things in is in that fourth position here, second predicate position. Following the noun with no article repeated. That's by far the most common position, but it's not the only position. And he's given you examples here from the New Testament. Well, I guess most of these phrases are taken from the New Testament, in which you'll see it in all four of these positions. Okay, any questions on any of that? Yes, Dale.
Is there any reason why they call it a predicate position if it really doesn't constitute predication?
Well, I think it's primarily because of the word order and the structure to relate to cut down your memory load as far as what positions these things will occur in comparison to the adjective. And because it's not only the adjective that these positions are defined for. We'll see a little bit later on that these same four positions are used quite frequently throughout the structure of Greek, and so they want to try to relate to that general pattern. So that's usually, and this is pretty typical of the textbooks, so they do talk about these positions. And it's mainly a word order position. If you think of it in terms of a word order position, then, and because they call it predicate position, just because they've already labeled that for that position. And so I guess if the genitive phrase discussion had come first, they might just have four different positions labeled, and then when they talked about the adjective, call the last two predicate ones. But as it turns out, usually the adjective is what you're dealing with first, so it's just kind of a matter of how the grammarians got together and labeled these things. Okay. Okay, section 79 is just basically talking about the fact that the meanings aren't any different, even though they've got these four positions, and then there's some biblical examples of all four positions. Section 80 is talking generally about the meaning, again saying in summary that you can generally translate a genitive in Greek by the prepositional phrase in English with the word of. And that's probably the safest way to translate it, at least in the surface, at least for the first attempt. And it'll generally put you in pretty good position as far as understanding what's happening. But he goes on to say that there are a lot of fine refinements in the meaning. There's a lot of different various shades of meaning that can be conveyed by the genitive. The basic idea is that of, and it's also related as something pointing to definition or showing the kind of something. And that includes the idea of possession. It includes what we call objective and subjective genitives and other things that we'll deal with later on. So he lists a number of examples in the scriptures where genitives are used, each of which is giving a little bit different perspective toward it. In Romans 1:1, doulos Iesu Christou, a servant of Jesus Christ. And this could be construed several ways. You could say Jesus Christ's servant. In other words, a servant possessed by Jesus Christ. That's probably one of the essential ideas. Or it could be considered what we'll call later an objective genitive, in which you're saying you're a servant of Jesus Christ. In other words, Jesus Christ is the one you're serving. You're serving him. And it's almost as though he is the object of your servitude. And that's what we call an objective genitive. And really, probably both of those ideas are involved. You're a servant possessed by Jesus Christ, and you're a servant who is serving Jesus Christ. But it's ambiguous in Greek as to which one it is. And it's also ambiguous in English, in just the same way. To say a servant of Jesus Christ can mean both of those things. And so can the Greek genitive phrase. That's why I've said that there's ambiguity in the Greek and there's ambiguity in the English, but the ambiguity in this case happens to be pretty much along the same lines. Okay? And we'll spend some time in the second year when we're dealing with genitive phrases in our translations, considering these various options and possibilities. It's always good to know what your options are in a particular instance, even though you may not always be able to decide with dogmatism exactly which one it must be. It's good to know what the range of possibilities is so that you can get a little bit more fullness out of that passage that is really there. To evangelion tou theou, the gospel of God. Well, this the gospel of God. In other words, this gospel is being defined by the phrase God. God is somehow qualifying what gospel we're talking about here. The gospel of God. Now, that could be the gospel possessed by God, God's gospel. It could be the gospel which is whose object is God. So the gospel of God is showing us God. But in some sense, the word gospel is being qualified and defined by the word God. It's the God kind of gospel, you see. And that's probably the most basic idea of the genitive, is showing the kind of the thing. We get the word genos and so forth from the same root as genitive, the idea of kind. So essentially describing the kind of gospel we're talking about. Okay, to evangelion tes basileus, the gospel of the kingdom. Again, telling you something about the kind of gospel we're talking about. Now it's characterizing it a little bit differently than earlier. And the gospel of the kingdom kind of gospel, you see. And the least of the apostles, so elachistos ton apostolon, the least of the apostles. In this sense, it's more in the sense of the least among the apostles, the least one of that class or group. So you've got a slightly different flavor to it, but in English we're still translating it up. A root of bitterness, risa picrias, root of bitterness. What kind of root? Root of bitterness, a bitterness kind of root. That's what we're talking about. Okay. Now, sometimes the Greek genitive is best translated by an English adjective. This is somewhat debatable, as I mentioned before. O krites tes adikias, the unrighteous judge. He says literally the judge of unrighteousness. He's got a point in one sense, and I think he's making a mistake in another sense. The sense in which he has a point is that when you're translating from one language to another, you're trying to put things into the idiomatic structure of the language that you're trying to translate into. And so in English, it isn't very often that we talk about the judge of unrighteousness. In other words, we don't usually use that kind of a figure of speech to describe what we're saying. And so there's a certain justification for translating it by an English adjective. Yet on the other hand, because Greek has both kinds of structures, Greek does have the capability of using an adjective. Because of that fact, I would be a little bit more careful about this, and it's one thing, at least in your exegesis, at least when you're doing biblical exegesis, I think it's very important to make a distinction between a genitive phrase modifier and an adjective. Because in many instances, both are equally possible in Greek, and the Holy Ghost will choose one or the other. And there is a slight difference in flavor. I think you can all sense the difference between the unrighteous judge and the judge of unrighteousness. The judge of unrighteousness is more of a Hebrewism type of expression, and it tends to be more powerful, more expressive than just saying the unrighteous judge. And it can open it up to several other possibilities, too. It may not be that the man is unrighteous himself, but he's judging unrighteousness. You have to look at context sometimes to tell. Now, in this case, you know, it is talking about a judge who is unrighteous. But the phrase judge of unrighteousness could conceivably be a reference to God who is judging unrighteousness. You see, and that would be considered an objective genitive. So you have to be a little careful. Take a closer look at it before you just translate a genitive phrase by an adjective. Be sure that that's the context really is pointing that way. Okay. Some cases there'd be maybe no problem, but I would just caution you to pay a closer attention to that and don't just gloss things over. I don't like to get too loose with Greek and just gloss everything over, because we have found many cases that the difference between this or that can make quite a difference in the impact of a particular passage. And remember that the Holy Ghost chose things according to what was available and is using various expressions to express a thought. We want to transmit that as accurately as we possibly can. Okay. Questions? Any questions about the genitive case then, as far as this chapter is concerned? And as I said, we are not by any means through with the genitive case. We will be looking at that in far more detail later on. All right, the dative case, chapter 11. Again, he gave you examples of the dative case in use, and then some exercises to summarize that into paradigms. So there's not much more to say about that, except looking at section 82, the forms of the dative. There we are seeing examples of these various types of first declensions, first declension nouns, and the various differences among them. And I guess the most significant thing is the same thing we've seen with the genitive, is that in the first declension, when you have the ada types, you're going to get ada endings all the way through. The alpha types are going to get alpha endings all the way through. But there are those some other kinds, like doxa, where you get alphas in the nominative and the accusative, and adas in the genitive, and now also in the dative. So you can see that as a full paradigm. And he does, for the first time, introduce us to first declension masculine nouns with alpha type endings rather than ada type endings. It's the first place he puts one down in a paradigm. I think I put it on the board for you earlier anyway. But aho neanias, for example. Neanias. You see there that we're dealing with, it's ho neanias, so you know it's a masculine, but it's first declension. And because the stem ended in an iota, you use the alpha type endings rather than the ada type endings. And so it's ho neanias, tu neaniu, and you get the omicron upsilon there in the first declension masculines in the genitive. But then you get the alpha types in the rest of the paradigm, to neania and ton neanian. So that's one to pay attention to. And then take note of Judas there, ho Judas, tu Juda, to Juda, and ton Judan. So the unusual features there, it's very much like neanias, except for the genitive form, which has an alpha instead of omicron upsilon. Otherwise, it's the same. So that'd be a good way to remember it, I suppose. Then the declension of Jesus, Jesus, is irregular, so they're just giving you the forms. And omicron upsilon sigma is the unusual feature. And in the omicron upsilon diphthong occurs all throughout the paradigm. The genitive and the dative forms are identical. As far as the word is concerned, the article, of course, is different. So other than that, it's pretty straightforward. Okay. Syntax of the dative. This is a little bit more involved than the genitive, just because the dative is used for what we term the indirect object very frequently, as well as some other things. And so he gives you first the syntax of the dative with reference to the indirect object. First looking at the English, and the child gave the dog a bone. The child is the subject, gave is the verb, the dog is the indirect object, and a bone is the direct object. And changing the word order between direct object and indirect object will change the meaning of the sentence in English, because word order, again, is the thing in English that's tipping you off. Although in English we can also use a prepositional phrase too to denote the indirect object. In fact, that's a less ambiguous way of doing it. And so we can also say the child gave a bone to the dog. And once we use the prepositional phrase, then we are a little bit more relaxed as far as our word order. We could say, the child gave to the dog a bone, or we can say, a child gave a bone to the dog. We can change that word order. We could even put out the front, for that matter, to the dog, the child gave a bone, maybe for more poetic purposes. But with that prepositional phrase, we lose some of the ambiguity, and we relax the requirements on word order. So that's something to take note of, to be watching for when you're seeing an English sentence. The direct, indirect object may be denoted either by its word order position, following the verb but before the direct object, or by the prepositional phrase to. Either way, in Greek, it's going to come out as dative case. Okay, then section 84 is looking at the basic, well, I guess it's still talking mainly about the English. In section 85, you're dealing with the Greek structure. And in the Greek structure, again, our labels are different. Instead of having 1, 2, and 3, we have nominative, dative, and accusative. So now in the nominative, verb, dative, now in the dative, and now in the accusative, and the word order is variable. And then the last is just some examples of this in use. And the translations of the dative in Greek are not always indirect objects. Sometimes they're going to be translated in English by prepositional phrases to or for. And we'll be getting more familiar with this again later on as we look at the dative case in more detail and do some more refinement on it. Do we have any questions on any of the, any of this business on the dative case? Basically, think of it as indirect object or prepositional phrase in English. Sometimes you can see the range of the translations here. Maybe I should run through these one more time just to give you a feeling for the range of the meanings of this. Section 85 then just says the Greek dative in sentences with structure noun, nominative, verb, noun, dative, noun, accusative can frequently be rendered as the indirect object of the English sentence with structure, subject, verb, indirect object, object. It can also be rendered by phrases with to or for, whether or not it can be rendered by the indirect object. So if it can be rendered by the indirect object, then it'll often be able to be translated by to. But some cases it may not be able to be rendered by an indirect object. It just isn't that structure in English. It doesn't fit into that idiom in English. And so sometimes it'll be translated other ways in English. And so the most common of these are illustrated below. Otha os tohuio exousian edoken. God gave the Son authority, or God gave authority to the Son. There's a straightforward indirect object sense. No problem there. Otha os tois judaiois nomus etheken. God made the Jews laws, or God made laws for the Jews. And again, because the laws are being made for something, for the benefit of something in this sense, it's translated for the Jews rather than to the Jews. And that's perfectly all right. That's of course, in Greek, there's no distinction being made there. It's just that the dative is showing interest of some sort. And so the laws are being made in the interest of the Jews. That might even be a way to translate it, actually. But more simply, in English, we just say the laws are made for the Jews. In other words, for the benefit of the Jews. Okay, ho krites katekriken thanato ton doulon. The judge condemned the slave to death. Okay, now in this case, to death isn't really the indirect object, but it's a prepositional phrase idea that is it's really an adverbial prepositional phrase. It's modifying the verbal idea. Condemned what? Condemned to death. So it's kind of completing the idea of your verb. It's an adverbial prepositional phrase. But here it's translated to. In other words, the reason you know it's not an indirect object is because you couldn't say the judge condemned death the slave. You see, you can't put it in that position we call indirect object position. And so we know it's a prepositional phrase. Okay, and then let me see. Let's look at the next. Not the next example, the one after that. Hostratiotes longhe tain pleuran enuxen. The soldier pierced the side with a spear. Notice longhe is the dative form of spear, and they're translating with a spear. And the Greek doesn't, of course, have the word with, but in English idiom we're translating it with because this is what's termed an instrumental sense. And we're going to be doing some more exploration in this area of instrumentals instrumentals and locatives later on, but that's the situation that's happening here. The idea in the Greek is the soldier pierced the side with reference to a spear, or in the realm of a spear. And in other words, that's the location within which the action was performed, on a conceptual plane, not on a physical plane. And so in English idiom we say with. Yes.
In the previous, in the genitive case,
mm-hmm.
we're seeing how these take an adjective idea, but here this almost has an adverbial idea. Look,
yes.
Thanato is describing the verb condemned to death, slave, and then you know, pierced with a spear at the side.
Yes, if you look at almost all of these, that is, well, let's see, was faithful to the Lord. That's more of an adjectival idea, but nevertheless, to be faithful, that's almost got a verbal idea. I think you're, and then to the Lord is modifying the adjective, which is still an adverbial function. So I think that's a good observation. That's generally what you do see, that the dative is usually associated with the action. And as such, it's got an adverbial function. I won't say that as a hard and fast rule, because there's lots of complications here. But as a general observation, you are in fact seeing the dative sense being related more to an adverbial modifier. You'll see when you diagram, this will be pretty apparent. When we diagram Greek sentences in the second year, we will see that indirect objects, so forth, often are slung down beneath the verb. They're adverbial, and you've got an adverbial sense to this, and this is pretty consistent. I'm trying to think of examples where that would not be the case. About the only thing is when you get into infinitives, participles, and this type of thing, you'll see the same thing. But even there, because infinitives and participles have adjectival and noun type functions as well as verb functions. Infinitive is kind of like a verbal noun, and a participle is like a verbal adjective. You get this verbal element in both of those, and that lends you to dative uses also. And still, you've got an adverbial type of function there. So I think it's a good observation. Look at the next example. Jesus was speaking the word with boldness. Again, he's speaking with boldness, and there is an adverbial modifier. Well, later on when we talk about the adverb, you'll see that there's a lot of similarity between the adverb itself, the idea of the adverb, and this dative idea too as well. Blessed are the pure in heart. Well, here's pure in heart. Pure is an adjective, but we can modify adjectives with adverbs. See, that's the normal mode. And so the phrase in heart is functioning adverbially, modifying the adjective pure. Okay. Zacchaeus was small in stature, same thing, small adjective being further qualified by in the realm of stature, you see. And you can see this idea of locative idea of small, pure in the realm of the heart, small in the realm of stature. Faithful, the apostle was faithful to the Lord. Pistos to kurio ein. Same kind of an idea there, faithful. But with reference to the Lord, in the realm of the things that pertain to the Lord, that's the realm within which he's faithful. Disciples have peace, and literally, this is erene estin tois mathetais. Literally, peace is to the disciples. Now, the Hebrew students will recognize this idiom, because this is very indicative of Hebrew. Hebrew uses, when Hebrew wants to say someone has something, they'll say something is to something, to that one. That's the idiom that they use. And this is really a Hebrew idiom that's translated into Greek, and then we're translating back into English. Okay. But you can see the sense. Peace is to the disciples. Peace is oriented toward them. Okay. There's this idea of possession that you can see. So it's getting almost akin to the genitive, but it's in a little bit different frame of mind. Okay, questions or observations? Yes, Steve.
Seems like there's even just sort of an English word which has the same kind of function that all sort of demand a certain certain preposition to go with them, like betray to the soldiers.
Yes.
It's kind of like it has to be. It demands that certain preposition to go with them. To the stores, like you don't just say I'm going. You're going where? You have to automatically take a certain prepositional.
Exactly. You'll see that later on. We'll get into this situation in more detail, but there are verbs in Greek also that take objects, what we would normally associate with the object, but it'll be in the dative or it'll be in the genitive, just because of the meaning of the verb. It's because the verb has a certain kind of a meaning that is associated with a certain case function that goes with it. And it's a little surprising. You're looking for an accusative, and there you see a dative or something. But in those situations, the dative or the genitive is not diverging from the basic idea of the genitive and dative that we've already seen. It's just that the verbal idea is setting you up for a different type of expression. And sometimes, of course, prepositions will be used too. And sometimes in the Greek, the preposition will come right onto the verb itself. So we'll have lots of fun with that when we get to it. But that's a good observation. That's true in English and in Greek, that certain verbal concepts demand a different type of an idea than just a simple direct object idea. Okay? Yes, Mark?
The dative can go anywhere in the sentence.
Right.
Is there
right.
a place where it is usually found, or is this one that is...
This one's real variable. It's so variable that I don't know if I could establish any kind of even a general observation as to where it most often comes. Unlike the genitive, see, with the genitive phrase, you can say most often it's going to occur in that fourth position. But see, this element is not an element that's related to or dependent on some other single element in the sentence. See, the genitive phrase was attributing, was modifying a noun. And so because it was modifying a noun, it had to have a certain position relative to that noun. Whereas dative functions will often either be prepositional phrasal ideas or they'll be indirect object ideas, in which case they're standing as a certain functional element within the whole sentence structure. And because of that, they're not really being ruled by a rule of concord, relating to something else. They are pretty much another major autonomous element within the sentence. They've got a position relative to the rest of the sentence, but remember, your nominatives and your accusatives don't seem to be having any particular required order, and the same is true of the dative. If it's an indirect object, it's probably going to be found almost any place. If it's a prepositional phrase idea, it'll usually follow the, for example, in this case where you've got pure in heart, small in stature, and so forth, then it'll generally follow that adjective. In other words, if it's an adverbial phrase modifying an adjective, it's generally going to follow that adjective so you know what it's stuck to. But as far when it's an indirect object and functioning that way, or if it's a prepositional phrase that's pretty much independent of some other, it's not an adverbial one modifying an adjective or something, then it's liable to be almost anywhere. And emphasis is going to be your main key in deciding. But I haven't seen enough of a pattern to be able to say this is what it's regularly. That was regularly seen. In Hebrew, there's a more regular pattern, but not in Greek. Okay? Any other questions on dative case? All right. We put the paradigm on the board for the... just summarizing all of this information. Does anybody have any further questions about the paradigms that we put on the board? You'll be responsible for that paradigm on the test, so you'll need to know your first declension and your second declension thoroughly. In the first declension, you've got to be aware of the variations between the feminines and the masculines, and then also between the stems that end in consonant and the stems that end in row, and being aware of the existence of a certain other kinds also. Now, the only ones, the other kinds you'd be responsible for, I think, on the test would be those that were on the vocabulary quiz before. I think we had doxa. Was there anything else? Do we have any double sigma type? I can't remember what we had on our vocab list. Let's see if I can find it here. Doxa, I think, is the only one as far as specifics that you'll have to be concerned about. I think that's right. Let me see. Okay, yeah, I think that's right. So doxa is about the only one that you'll have as an other kinds that you'll have to be aware of. But on the paradigm, of course, you don't have the noun part anyway. You just fill out the endings. The masculines, again, you have the variation between the types that end in row or a vowel and the other types, but there's no other kinds in the masculine category. And the nice thing about first declension is the plurals are all the same. So once you've learned what the plural endings are, they're the same for feminines and masculines. They're the same whether the stem ends in a row or a vowel or not. They're the same for those other kinds. And the genitive plural is the same in all the paradigms, omega nu. Second declension, you just have masculines or feminines. They're both the same. And then the neuters. They're slightly different in the nominative and accusative anyway. Article paradigm, main thing there is the endings are pretty straightforward. Ada types for the feminine first declension. The masculines get second declension types. The neuters get second declension types. The only major thing there, I think, that aside from that, that you need to pay attention to is the letter tau, which forms have tau and which forms don't. And it's pretty simple to remember. Just the masculines and feminines, nominative forms, the singular and plural, don't have the tau. All the rest of the forms do. And the ones that don't have tau will have a rough breathing. So you know you either got a rough breathing or a tau on it. And so ho, hey, hoi, and hi are the four forms that don't have the tau. All the rest of them have tau. And maybe the only other unusual feature is in the neuter. For the article, it's to, not tone, for the nominative and accusative. So you have to watch for that. I'm trying to tell you where the mistakes are most commonly made. Over the years, you find out where people make their mistakes, and that's one of them. So watch for that article on the nominative and accusative singular for the neuter. It's to rather than tone. It's slightly different than the endings on the nouns themselves. Okay. Any other questions on those? Now, adjectives also. The regular adjectives that we've seen so far, which are, I suppose you could call first and second declension adjectives, because the adjectives will, of course, decline for masculine, feminine, and neuter, and in doing so, they're going to use second declension endings for the masculine forms, first declension endings for the feminine forms, in most cases, and second declension for the neuter forms. And the only unusual feature there is the adjectives like ionios that take the same endings for both masculine and feminine, so be watching for that. Okay, questions or problems with the paradigm? Okay, then the only other thing on the test is going to be these rules of accent. So you may want to take a look again at pages 317 following. We'll just take a quick review of this, and I'll tell you exactly what you'll need to know for the test. Basically, on the test, what I'm going to be putting on there is some forms with the accents in the wrong place, or maybe the right place. And what you need to do is tell me if any of the rules are being violated by the position of the accent. And so just tell, it'll be a kind of thing, I'll give you a form and you have to tell me what's wrong with it, if there's anything wrong. There may not be anything wrong with it, but if there is anything wrong, you need to tell me. Okay? And so with that in mind, the things that you'll have to know to decide that is, first of all, you'll have to know what three accents there are, what three accents exist, you know, the grave, circumflex, and the acute. And then you'll need to know vowel lengths. You'll need to know what vowels are long and what vowels are short. And so you'll need to know this in the bottom of page 317, top of 318. Epsilon and omicron are always short. Eta and omega are always long. Alpha, iota, and upsilon are sometimes long, sometimes short. Now, in the cases where they're sometimes long, sometimes short, I'm obviously not going to require you to guess whether it's long or short. Sometimes the only way you can tell is because of the accent and so forth. So I'm not going to be playing that kind of game with you to try to make you guess and so forth. If I ever did that, I'd tell you whether to consider it long or short. So don't worry about that as far as, but you need to be aware of the fact that the alpha, the iota, and the epsilon can sometimes be long, sometimes be short. The diphthongs are long. So remember, the diphthongs are always long except for alpha iota and omega, excuse me, omicron iota, when they're final, when they're the last thing in the word. And that's going to be, of course, in your nominative forms, primarily nominative plural forms. Improper diphthongs are also considered long. And then syllable breakdown, you don't need to worry about these five rules down here at the bottom of the page on the footnote for deciding where the consonants split. Don't worry about that, because I'm not going to be testing on those details. As far as the syllables are concerned, all you need to know is that each vowel or diphthong constitutes a syllable. And if that's all you really know in order to decide where the accent falls anyway. So you don't have to worry about splitting hairs on these various consonants. Okay. Designations of the syllables. You'll need to be familiar with this terminology. The last syllable is called the ultima. The second to the last is called the penult. And the third to the last, if you want to term it that way, is the antepenult. So we're only dealing with the last three syllables in a word. Those are the only three syllables that can take an accent. So those are the only three syllables that we're interested in as far as accent rules are concerned. All right. Then, the general rules of accent. And you'll need to be familiar with these five rules so that you can make the kinds of distinctions, and that'll be it as far as the test is concerned. So rule one is a word may be accident only on one of its last three syllables. That's the first limiting factor. B, no word may have more than one accent unless it's followed by an enclitic. Don't worry too much about enclitics right now because we just haven't dealt with them enough to be using them. You've seen them in your translations, but we haven't really dealt with enough of them to be worried about it. We'll take up more, that'll become more important later on. Then rule two, number A, part A, the acute accent may stand on one of the last three syllables of a word, only on one of the last three syllables. And B, the circumflex accent may stand on only one of the last two syllables of a word. That's got a little bit more limitation. And C, the grave accent may only stand on the last syllable of a word. So that's a pretty easy rule to remember, I think. Acute can be one of the last three, circumflex only in the last two, and grave only in the last one. So if you ever see a grave accent, if I give you a form that's got a grave accent on the second to last syllable, you can tell me it's wrong without knowing anything else just because of the fact it can't stand on the second to last syllable. And if you see a circumflex on the antipenal, you say, that's wrong. Circumflex can't be on the antipenal. That's all you need to know. So that's the kind of thing I'm going to be asking you on the test. Then thirdly, the acute accent may stand on either a long or short syllable. The circumflex may stand only on a long syllable. So there's another thing. If you see a circumflex on a short syllable, you see a circumflex over an omicron or something like that, you know that's wrong. The grave accent may stand on either a long or short syllable. So grave can be either long or short. But circumflex can only be on a long. Number four, if the ultima is short. Now these last two rules are probably the hardest ones to remember, because you're having to decide whether something's long or short, and then there's several complications that arise from that. If the ultima is short, the antipenult, if accented, may have only the acute accent. So antipenult would be the third to the last syllable, in other words. So if the ultima is short, the antipenult, if accented, may have only the acute accent. Well, you already knew that it can't have either the circumflex or the grave, because grave can only stand on the last syllable, circumflex can only stand on the second to the last syllable. So you already really know that from the other rules. But part B, the penult, if accented, must have the circumflex if it itself is long, but the acute if it itself is short. So that's something you don't really know yet. If the penult, the second to last syllable, is accented, and it's not saying it will be accented, it's just saying if it's accented, it must have the circumflex if it's short, if it itself is long, excuse me, and the acute if it itself is short. So now this is all under the condition that the ultima is short. So Zalos, for example, the ultima is short, the penult is accented, and the penult has an eta. Eta is always long, so it has to be a circumflex for the accent on this one. And then further on down here you have nomos. Again, the ultima is short, the penult is accented, the penult happens to have a short syllable on it, short vowel, and therefore it has to be the acute. And of course, you know it couldn't be a circumflex anyway, because circumflex won't stand on a short syllable. Okay, and then C, the short ultima may itself have an acute accent, provided that a mark of punctuation or an enclitic immediately follows. If a word other than an enclitic immediately follows, the acute is changed to a grave. Okay, the short ultima may itself have an acute accent. Why couldn't it have a circumflex? Right, it could only be on a long. See, if the ultima is short, by definition, it can't have the circumflex. By this previous rule, it can't have the circumflex. So that's why he's only talking about whether it's got an acute or a grave. Circumflex can't be on it because it's short. Okay? So it may, it'll normally have the acute accent, but if the word immediately follows, that is not an enclitic, in other words, if there's another word following it that's got an accent in it, then the acute is changed to a grave. But if the word following doesn't have an accent, it can stay acute. Okay, and then there's one exception with the word tis and t. They always retain the acute accent. And again, the only thing I can figure is it must have something to do with intonation. There must have been an intonation change between the grave and the acute that we're not able to pick up now. And that might have had something to do with the idea of a question, giving an intonation pattern right at the beginning, and maybe that's the reason why acute is always on it. So you've got that consistent pattern. It's only a guess, but I think it's a reasonable guess. Okay, then rule number five, if the ultima is long. So then we have to consider that. If the ultima is long, the antipenult cannot have an accent. So when you've got a long ultima, then you can accent can only be on the last two syllables, not on one of the last three. It's got some limitations now. B, the penult, if accented, may have only the acute. That's regardless of whether it's long or short. If the last syllable is long, then regardless of where the penult is long or short, the best it can have is an acute. And then C, the long ultima itself may have either the circumflex or the acute, because remember, if the ultima is long, a long syllable can take the circumflex as well as the acute. And so you don't really know whether it has the circumflex or the acute, but it can have either one. And if it has the acute, it's changed to a grave according to the same rule that we saw before. If the word following it has an accent, then it's going to be changed to the grave. Okay? Questions on any of these rules? Yes?
On these accents, do they actually have some kind of a grammatical function other than just the tone?
Not generally, but there will be some cases later on. We'll get into things called contract verbs, in which there's the verb stem ended in a vowel, and you put another vowel sound on the end of it, and the two vowels contract. And to show the contraction, very often a circumflex accent is used. In other words, and that accent can make a difference in between one form and another. The same will be true when we get to subjunctive forms. There'll be certain, in some forms, in the paradigms, the forms just happen to work out by the rules to be the same form, as far as the ending is concerned, with some other, say, in the indicative or something like that. And the only difference between them will be the accent. So in cases like that, we will lay some emphasis and stress upon the fact that the accent here is making a difference in the form. Some futures that don't take a sigma stem because of, you know, they're irregular or something, will take a shift in the accent instead. And that'll make them look like a present form. There won't be any difference in between the present. For example, the verb crino, there's a crino is the present, and crino is the future. Just the change in the stress is what made the difference. So in those cases, there will be a grammatical difference, and in those cases, we will lay some emphasis on it. And I'll tell you when those instances come up so that you'll know that you have to learn the accent very definitely on this form. But in general, it's not going to make a difference. The general rule is that there are not that many words that differ only in accent, and therefore the general answer to the question is no, but there are some exceptions. Okay? Any questions about what you're responsible for on these accent rules? No more than what I've just said. If you know these five rules here on section 391, if you know what constitutes a syllable and whether and how to tell whether the syllable is long or short according to the rules, then you'll be able to identify the places where mistakes occur. And that's all I need you to know now. You will not have to be able to, you will not be required to predict where the accent falls on a given word, because with these rules you don't have enough information to do that. You know where it can't be sometimes, but there's still a lot of options as to what it can be. And as I said, the only real ultimate answer to that is to learn the, if it's a noun, you learn it. A noun or an adjective, you learn it as part of the dictionary form. If it's a verb, you learn it as part of the dictionary form also. But then the accents will change during the inflection of the paradigm. In the nouns, in the various declensions, the next couple of pages give you some more specifics that happen as a result of the declensions. Because you see, what will often happen is, say, for example, you've got the word anthropos. And in the nominative form, the accent falls on the on which syllable? Anthropos. What syllable would the accent fall on? What would be the label for that syllable? Antipenult. Okay, it falls on the antipenult. Now, in the genitive, the form is anthropou. Now, there's been an accent shift. And the reason for the accent shift is because in the genitive, in the nominative, the ending is omicron sigma. Is that short or long? Short. In the genitive, the ending is omicron upsilon. That's long. That's a diphthong. So you've gone from a short to a long. Now remember what Rule 5 said, that with a long ultima, the accent cannot be on the antipenult. And that's the reason why it has to shift. So that's the kind of technicalities you get into. And the same thing happens in verbs, because verbs add endings, and sometimes you get, you know, two syllable endings added onto the stem, and of course that's going to change the whole structure of the word. And if the accent was near the front, it's going to have to slide down toward the rear, you see, in order to be on one of the last three syllables. If you're adding syllables onto something, it's very possible to get your accent out of the range of the last three syllables, so it has to move down. So that's basically the kind of thing that's going to happen. And we'll take some time to go through the more specific rules a little bit later on, especially after we get through the verbs so we can do them all together. Okay? Any other questions? All right, let's take a look then. We've got a few minutes left. So be ready for the quiz next Tuesday, a week from today, lessons 7 to 11 and the accent rules. And you'll need to be aware of your vocabulary that you had before in order to... I won't be giving you anything, holding you responsible for any vocabulary that's not on that other list that you already had. Let's put it that way. All right. Lesson 12, then. Chapter 12. This is our first introduction to the Greek verb. We've all already translated certain things as Greek as verbs, a verb to be, and this type of thing because of predicate structures, but this will be the first time we actually get a real live Greek verb to look at. Okay, the majority of sentences in English and Greek contain verbs as essential constituents. Verbs in both languages may be defined paradigmatically as inflected words whose inflectional forms indicate certain grammatical categories. In English, these categories are those of person, number, and tense. So a verb form in English is going to be inflected, that is, it's going to change its forms. It'll have endings or some stem change or something to indicate person, number, and tense. By person, we mean first, second, or third person, meaning I, you, or he, she, or it in the singular. And then number, singular or plural, and tense, basically past, present, future, that type of thing, although there's more complications than that to it, especially in Greek. Okay, in other words, tense is dealing with a time value of the verb, whether the action takes place in the past, the present, or the future, or whether it's completed action. This gets into a little bit tricky distinction. In Greek, we would probably tend to call whether it's completed action or continuous action something called aspect rather than tense, because if we restrict tense just to the time element, the kind of action is also seen in Greek verbs, and I guess I'll have to wait till we get to the discussion of the Greek verb to really point that out. Okay, for example, the English verb walk has the form walks in which the morpheme s indicates third person singular number. So here's the paradigm for the Greek verb walk. We have first person singular, I is walk, second person singular plural, you walk, third person plural, we walk, third person plural, they or the soldiers, if it's a specific noun, walk, third person singular, he, she, it, or the soldier walks. So we only really have two basic forms here in the present tense, and some of them just are walk, and others just is walks with the S. Similarly, the verb walk has the form walked, ED, in which the morpheme represented by ED indicates past time. So we're just introducing you to the fact that in English we do inflect our verbs a little bit, but you're probably accustomed to expecting by now that Greek's going to inflect things a lot more than Greek English does, and you're right. The inflectional system of Greek verbs is much more elaborate. Inflectional forms serve to indicate not only person, number, and tense, but also mood, voice, and aspect, which are indicated in English by syntactic devices. Now, it's not that English doesn't indicate mood, voice, and aspect. It just does it by different devices. It doesn't do it with inflections on the verb form. He gives a footnote down here for his examples. Examples such structures as, if I were you, that's a subjunctive type of expression. See, but in English, we're doing it with an auxiliary verb. If I were you, see, or we're using the a regular form of the verb to be, but in a little bit different sense. We may not go. We're using the auxiliary verb may to indicate possibility and so forth. And that would also be indicated in Greek by a subjunctive verb form with just a separate inflections. They have seen. There's a perfect sense. We're getting that from the auxiliary verb have, but in Greek we'll have a perfect verb form. That will they won't use auxiliary verbs. They'll use a perfect verb form and a separate paradigm for the verb to indicate that meaning. He was seen and you were walking. So we're the same kind of thing. So we've got a lot to learn as far as the Greek verb is concerned. Some of you have seen the charts of the full paradigm. There's one in the other library over there. There's Dane and Manti has a chart for the me conjugation and the omega conjugation for the Greek verb, and you got, you know, a big sheet of paper that folds out like that with all these forms on it. So it's rather impressive that when you get all the forms put together. Fortunately, you won't be required to learn all of that at once. We're going to be spending the whole year going through the various forms of those piece by piece. And you'll also notice that there are relationships between those forms, so it's not a matter of having to learn all a whole page full of all different forms. Many of the ending systems are common. The only difference is that there's a slight stem change, the addition of a sigma or something like this, the addition of an augment on the front or something like that, and then the endings are the same. So it's not quite as bad as it looks when you first take a look at it. And then there are some of the forms that you don't use that very, very often. The optative, they're only used a few times in the whole New Testament, and so we're not going to spend a lot of time with things that aren't going to be used that much. Okay, now, let's get our baptism here in the first forms in Greek. A comparison of the Greek forms below with their English equivalents will reveal some of the similarities and differences between the verb systems of the two languages. Okay, first of all, the verb luo is the verb that we use as a model verb. It's most common, you know, almost all the paradigm charts I've seen use luo because it's a very regular verb and doesn't do any funny things. That's the main reason. And its stem ends in a vowel, so it's nice. You can add your sigmas on and so forth. You don't get any funny things happening there. So luo is about as nice and regular as you can get. Okay, so luo is the form meaning I loose or I am loosing. I loose or I am loosing. Present tense, first person, singular, I form. A luace, epsilon, iota, sigma, is the U form. U singular, loose, U singular, are loosing. Lue, epsilon, iota ending, is he, she, it looses, he, she, or it is loosing. And it's also the form that you would use for any given noun that's a third person noun. The prophet, the widow, the child, and so forth, looses or is loosing. Same form, lue. And here's one that's a little unusual. Ta tekna, lue, the children are loosing. Now, what's happened here is that the form is really a third-person singular form, but the subject is a third-person plural, ta tekna, the children. But there's just a strange quirk that occurs with a neuter plural. A neuter plural noun will often use a singular verb. It doesn't always have to, but you'll often see a singular verb form used with it, with a neuter plural noun. So it only works with neuter plurals. We'll stop. There's a note on this in the rest of the text here. So, but that's about the only unusual feature that I can point out here. Okay, well, we'll have to stop there and continue with this tomorrow. We'll talk about the verb. No assignment for tomorrow.